The following KOPN podcast is made possible by the generous donations from listeners like you. Please consider a donation to listener-supported community radio, KOPN. You can donate securely online at kopn.org. Thank you. Hi, welcome to Food Sleuth Radio, where we help you think beyond your plate. I'm Melinda Hemmelgarn, a registered dietitian and investigative nutritionist on a mission to connect the dots between food, health, and agriculture and find food truth. And today I'm delighted to welcome my guest, Dr. Cynthia Curl. She's an associate professor and co-director at the Center for Excellence in Environmental Health and Safety at Boise State University. Dr. Curl founded and directs Boise State's Agricultural Health Lab, where her research is focused on the intersection between agriculture and human health. Her primary interests are in assessing human exposure to agricultural pesticides and improving health and safety in agricultural workplaces. Today, we'll be discussing her recent research on pesticide exposure during pregnancy and the impact of consuming organic versus conventional diets. Dr. Curl earned her PhD in Environmental and Occupational Health Sciences from the University of Washington, and prior to her doctoral training, she worked as a researcher for the Northwest Agricultural Safety and Health Center. She was named one of the 20 pioneers under 40 in environmental public health by the Collaborative on Health and the Environment. Welcome, Cynthia.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I think your research is so critical as we navigate how important it is to understand how we produce our food. But I'm curious to know, what led to your interest in environment and agriculture?
Sure, yeah. So I grew up in rural southern Virginia, on the eastern shore of Virginia, in between the Chesapeake Bay and the Atlantic Ocean. So a very different part of the state than kind of the northern Virginia, D.C. area. And I myself grew up on a farm. In fact, my first job was working as a secretary for our local potato farm. And my dad, actually, when he was in high school, his job was to hold the sticks up when crop dusters were spraying fields and then drop them and run and then go back and pick them up and move over one row so that they knew where to spray. So my family has a long history in agriculture. And when I went out to the University of Washington to get my graduate degree in environmental health, I was really taken by the work of the Pacific Northwest Agricultural Safety and Health Center, which is based out of the University of Washington. Their mission is to promote healthy agriculture and protect farm workers and folks in farming communities. And as a young student and having grown up where I did, that really spoke to me. And the first research project that I worked on was understanding how farm workers may inadvertently take home pesticides to their families on their clothes and work boots and things like that. And we were able to kind of document that pathway, which had previously been shown in fields like asbestos and mining, looking at other kinds of contaminants, but to show it in agriculture was new and important. And we were able to help with some interventions to try to get different farm owners to install places where workers could wash their clothes or leave their work boots. And so that was my first foray into this work, and it felt really important.
It is. And I am so interested in vulnerable populations. And I was curious about your research because you specifically looked at pregnant women. And I have been following some of the research looking at pesticide exposure during pregnancy and birth outcomes. Tell me why you specifically honed in on glyphosate.
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think that before researching glyphosate, I, like many pesticide researchers, was looking more at insecticides than herbicides. So I spent a long time looking at the organophosphate insecticides, which wonderful researchers in the Salinas Valley of California have shown to be associated with lots of neurological outcomes. When pregnant women are exposed, their children have higher likelihood of ADD, ADHD, and they tend to have deficits in IQ and memory. So there are many classes of pesticides beyond just glyphosate where birth outcomes have shown to be important. And glyphosate is another of those pesticides where the emerging information suggests that this may be one of the most sensitive subgroups. It's interesting. most exposures that we see in the general population and we see in our studies are well below the EPA's regulatory benchmark, where they say that glyphosate could be harmful. But that benchmark was set based on a 1983 rat study looking at kidney tubules as the most sensitive outcome. So the kinds of concentrations that would cause problems to the rat kidneys is what that safety benchmark is based on. A lot of the emerging animal evidence now is showing that that may not be the most sensitive endpoint, and that when we look at what it might be, it may have more to do with these birth outcomes. So we are seeing in animal studies and now also in human studies that prenatal exposure to glyphosate can be or has been associated with shorter gestational length, so a shortened time in utero, as well as decreased fetal growth and preterm birth.
Well, this is so important because it's during that last trimester when the brain develops most. So if we're shortening that time period that the baby is in utero, I would think that there would be some impact on neurological systems.
Well, yes. And there's a slew of health effects associated with shortened time in utero. So I think that the idea of moving specifically into preterm birth is known to have adverse health effects with it, but even just shortening that time in utero, as you mentioned, has its own challenges.
Right. So dietitians are taught to teach consumers how safe these herbicides are, that they target enzymatic pathways that are only found in plants. We don't have to worry. We need these herbicides to quote unquote feed the world. But like you, I am very concerned about unintended consequences. And I am based in the Midwest where we have a large acreage with genetically modified corn and soy, where these crops are heavily sprayed with glyphosate and now increasingly more with 2,4-D and dicamba, additional herbicides. But you are based in Idaho, and the population you looked at live around alfalfa fields and sugar beets, both of which are also sprayed with the herbicide glyphosate. And you've got some data in your papers explaining how persistent our exposure is to these herbicides.
Well, yes, I'll make one small adjustment there. It's not that it's persistent as much as it's consistent, I think, is the difference. The persistent pesticides, things that we have fortunately been able to kind of get rid of, things like DDT and the organochlorines that stick around for a long time. But I think what's important to think about with our more contemporary pesticides, which it's a good thing that they are not as persistent. Most of the pesticides we use today have biological half-lives, meaning the amount of time that they stay in somebody's body of less than a day, which is good. The problem is, if we eat them every single day, it kind of has the same effect as if they were persistent.
Right, exactly. And your study specifically looked at pregnant women from a WIC population. Is that correct?
Yes, we recruited all of the participants from our study from women, infants, and children clinics across the Snake River Valley of Idaho.
And it's my experience that individuals who are living in communities where there is a lower income group, it is more difficult to find foods that are organic or not sprayed with glyphosate.
Yes, and that was actually part of the reason for recruiting from that population. So our study had two main aims. We wanted to understand the influence of residential proximity to agriculture, so how close your home is to the nearest field, and the importance of organic versus conventional food consumption on glyphosate levels. So we recruited women who, half of whom lived less than 500 meters or about a third of a mile from the closest agricultural field, and half of whom lived further away. And we collected urine samples each week from the end of their first trimester until delivery and looked to see the influence of that residential proximity. We also did an organic diet crossover trial in all of the study participants where they consumed a week of conventional food and a week of organic food that we provided, randomized to order, to try to understand how much of their glyphosate exposure came from where they lived and how much of it came from what they ate.
Tell us what you found.
I have to tell you, it took me by surprise. What we found was that, first of all, The residential proximity played a large role. Women who lived closer to fields had significantly higher levels of glyphosate in their urine than women who lived farther away. However, and this is important, that was only true during the agricultural spray season. So during the winter, for example, the women who lived close to the fields looked exactly like the women who lived far from the fields in terms of their glyphosate exposure. But between May and August, the agricultural spray season, the exposures were much higher, but only for the women who live close to fields. And then from the organic diet intervention side of things, we actually did that intervention during the spray season intentionally to try to understand these relative sources of exposure. And I anticipated that the organic diet would lower the glyphosate exposures in all of our study participants. That wasn't exactly what we found. What we found was that consuming an organic diet lowered the exposure of the women who lived far from fields. So if you live in town and you eat organic, and that's your main source of glyphosate from the food you eat, when you switch from eating conventional to eating organic, it does lower your glyphosate exposure significantly. But for the women who lived close to fields, there was no difference when they switched to an organic diet. And that seems to be because they were getting so much exposure from their residential proximity that it kind of swamped out any effect of their dietary change.
I found this to be fascinating because I don't think we give enough attention to what you study, which is exposure science and how we are exposed. So your paper goes into the fact that it can get in dust, and so that just enters the house. You spoke about rainwater. We know, at least in the Mississippi River watershed, that we have glyphosate in our rainwater. Is that the case in Idaho too? Do you know?
I don't know. And this is a great question. And it really is the next question because we can't design effective interventions to change people's exposure unless we really understand how it's happening. And glyphosate is particularly interesting in this regard because we have a lot of pesticides. We talked about dicamba earlier that we know are volatile, that we know get airborne, that we know drift off target. You hear lawsuits all the time from farmers who, dicamba was being applied to the field next to theirs, but then it drifted and it killed their crops. Glyphosate doesn't have that kind of reputation. It doesn't have that kind of story around it that it drifts because it really isn't volatile, certainly not compared to other pesticides, just in terms of its chemical composition and how it behaves in the environment. And yet, here we are finding that women who live close to these agricultural fields have these higher levels during the spray season. And so, that really is the next question. Is it drifting through the air more than we realize? Is it getting in the rain? Is it adhering to the dirt in the fields and then just blowing into the homes? And it's really important to understand those differences because that changes the messaging. Do we need to make sure that people are being alerted when the farmer next to them is spraying so that they can close their windows? Do we need to put more emphasis on a deep clean when you're pregnant so that you can get the dust that may contain glyphosate out of your house? These are different actions depending on how it's getting into homes and into people.
Right. Let me take one break because we are halfway through, and I want to remind our listeners that if you're just joining us, you are tuned into Food Sleuth Radio. We are joined today by Dr. Cynthia Curl. She's an associate professor and co-director at the Center for Excellence in Environmental Health and Safety at Boise State University, and she also founded and directs Boise State's Agricultural Health Lab. Okay, let's talk about exposures. You mentioned, I believe, in your paper that you measured glyphosate levels, but not the metabolites from glyphosate. And I am curious, do you think metabolites also have a biological effect?
So this is really interesting. So for a lot of pesticides, the only thing we measure are metabolites. So when you think about organophosphate insecticides, they're not coming through our system and excreting unchanged. They get metabolized and you measure those products. That's not the case for glyphosate. Most of the glyphosate that we take in actually comes out as glyphosate. Now, some people measure something called AMPA, which is a breakdown product of glyphosate and is often referred to as a metabolite of glyphosate. But AMPA is interesting because our bodies don't make it. AMPA is made in the environment when the sun and the wind and the elements break down glyphosate, or when microbial activity, maybe even more so, breaks down glyphosate. And then when people consume oats that were treated with glyphosate, some of which has environmentally converted to AMPA, then they excrete both the glyphosate and the AMPA. I know that's kind of a long-winded explanation of that, but they really are two different things by the time we ingest them. There is some evidence to suggest that AMPA itself exerts toxic effects. And so for the studies that measure AMPA, that's what they're trying to understand. Some studies add up the amount of glyphosate and AMPA analyzed in urine samples to try to understand that total exposure. Because we were trying to understand these sources of glyphosate, we were really interested just in that parent compound, but I think there's plenty of reason to also be interested in its breakdown products.
Right, as well as the inert compounds that are also found in these formulations that we have no idea what they are many times, and we certainly don't know the synergistic reactions between, say, glyphosate and those inerts and how those interact with the body.
That's absolutely true. And I think we only hope that they're inert, right? I tend to think of them more as co-formulants. And we actually know that some of those can increase the toxicity of pesticides. So, for example, some of the co-formulants that are in several of the mixtures of glyphosate-based herbicides that are applied, they contain compounds that help the glyphosate permeate the leaves of the plants that they're being applied to when they're being used as a weed killer. And there's plenty of reason to suspect that they may also help permeate our skin or internal layers once ingested, because that's what they're designed to do. And that can increase the toxicity of the quote unquote active ingredients.
I wonder about our listeners' understanding of just how ubiquitous this chemical is. And I found different statistics. I believe it was the NHANES data. This is a nutrition and health examination study that looks at glyphosate in our urine. And well over 80% of the population has glyphosate in their urine. And also, what does that mean in terms of where we're getting it in the diet? Are we getting it from genetically modified foods? Is it coming from drift that goes on to other foods that are not engineered to withstand the spraying? You mentioned that in Idaho, you've got alfalfa and sugar beets. I don't know how many people realize that glyphosate is also used as a desiccant to spray on oats and lentils and beans to make sure that it can be harvested at the same time. It's all dry at the same time. So there are lots of routes of exposure into our diet, aren't there?
Yes, that's exactly right. I was going to say, you ask, are these ways that people are exposed? And the shorter answer, I think, is yes to all of these things. Your statistic is correct about the NHANES data set showing that more than 80% of the general US population has measurable levels of glyphosate in their urine. And interesting thing about that is that the NHANES collects what we call spot urine samples. So that's just a single urine sample collected kind of randomly whenever they're going in for the rest of their visit. And as we mentioned before, glyphosate has a biologic half-life of less than 24 hours. It's probably more on the order of 10 hours. And so that means that these samples are just taken randomly and they're just representing what you ate yesterday. And they're still showing up much more often than not as having levels of glyphosate in those samples. So that kind of means that every day, people, for the most part, are taking in enough glyphosate to be measured in a urine sample. Now, of course, the dose makes the poison, and whether those levels are harmful is a fully separate conversation that we can certainly have. But in terms of whether or not people are ingesting glyphosate from their diet, I think the answer is yes.
So, for the women who had more glyphosate in their urine, what was the outcome on their newborns?
That's actually kind of the next phase of the research that we would like to do in our lab. So our study was not intended to look at birth outcomes. There have been four, I think, well, very well designed epidemiologic studies that have preceded this that looked at associations between glyphosate levels prenatally and birth outcomes that showed these relationships. We were, to your point previously about exposure science, we were specifically doing an exposure assessment. And with 40 women in our study, we knew we didn't have the statistical power to look at health outcomes. I think what made our study powerful was that each of our study participants gave a sample every week from the end of their first trimester until delivery, and then daily during the 2 weeks that we did the organic diet intervention. And so we actually collected almost 1,400 urine samples from 40 women over a 6 month period in each of their lives. And that kind of sample density is really unheard of and is necessary if you want to understand exposures to a pesticide that has such a short biologic half-life.
So, based on what you've learned through your research, how do you educate pregnant women, or how might you advise dietitians who work with pregnant women? How would you suggest we counsel them on how best to eat to reduce exposure risk?
I understand your question for sure, and it's one that I hear a lot, and I have a lot of thoughts about this. First of all, I feel that it shouldn't be each of our individual responsibilities to try to make all these complicated decisions to make sure that we're eating safe food. I think it is a regulatory responsibility that if there is something in our food supply that could potentially cause adverse health effects, it should be removed from the food supply for everyone. Otherwise, you run the risk of a situation where people, for example, who can afford to eat organic have an option that people who can't afford to eat organic don't have. And I would never want to advocate for that as a solution. You know, eat organic if you can. At the same time, our regulatory process is, let's say, slow and imperfect at best. And so you don't want to take away people's agency and not suggest that there are things that they can do. I think that we're still trying to understand the complicated relationship between exposures to pesticides at these levels that are, as we talked about before, below regulatory benchmarks and potential adverse health effects. I think we know a few things pretty clearly. I think we know that eating an organic diet reduces people's biological levels of urinary biomarkers of many different synthetic pesticides. And if that's something that is important to someone, if that's something that they have the means to buy organic and the access to buy organic, that is a step that people can take. I also often, and this may be a little bit off the topic of pregnant women, but I do want to mention it. I often get asked whether I buy organic. And I have to say that another really compelling reason to choose organic is because the other side of my research looks at a different vulnerable population, which is the people that grow our food, all of the farm workers that work out in these agricultural fields. And we know that there are 10 to 20,000 agricultural workers that are acutely poisoned by pesticides each year. And so another reason to choose organic, if that's something people are able to do, is to try to reduce the burden on our agricultural workers when it comes to pesticide exposure.
I could not agree more. I think in our culture, it's such a me-driven society. What's good for me? But I do think that it is critical to think how our actions affect others. So yes, absolutely, I advocate organic food and farming, especially for those agricultural workers. We just have a few minutes left. What do you want our listeners to know about your research?
I think that the last few things I want to say, one more on your point of what I advise people, and I'm sure as a dietitian, you can appreciate that. I never want people to feel like, oh, I read that there's so many pesticides on fruits and vegetables, and I can't afford organic. Maybe I should eat fewer fruits and vegetables. I never want that to be the message. The health benefits of eating a diet rich in fruits and vegetables is well established, and we're still trying to understand whether or not the levels of pesticides found in those foods have the potential to cause harm, but we know eating fruits and vegetables is good for us, and especially during pregnancy. So I think that's one point that I want to make. I also think it's really compelling to think about the fact that we do use a lot of agricultural chemicals in food production. As you mentioned, that certainly increases crop yield per acre. And that's important. But we're seeing time and time again that the products that we use in growing our food end up in people's bodies. So we need to be thinking about those products, not just in terms of what they can do for agricultural production, but also thinking it all the way through and hopefully taking a little bit of a precautionary principle view of things and trying to look at this from, are we sure it's safe rather than can we prove that it causes harm and then we need to remove it only then?
Right. And I do think that we are accumulating more research data on crop yields with organic production systems. And that even though we're told by industry that we need these pesticides to increase crop yields, many organic farmers will tell you that their yields are just as good, if not better, especially during climate stress. And that if we're looking at quality of food and the protection of public health, that maybe shifting our opinions about our food away from quantity more towards quality might be a good path forward.
Yes, I think that's absolutely true. I also think that farmers are really innovative. And so another reason to suggest that people may want to choose organic is that the more we grow food that way, the more innovative and thoughtful and clever and solution focused people have an opportunity to be. And there are a lot of agricultural advancements that can be had if we didn't spend so much of our focus and look at the farm bill, so much of our subsidies on things that are taking us further away from those goals.
Absolutely. Well, I know you're doing other research. You have looked into crop uptakes of inorganic bromide following field fumigation with methyl bromide. You're working with Washington and Idaho potato commissions to improve worker health and safety during the Northwest potato production season. So your work is wide and varied, and I'm sure your students appreciate your perspectives.
Thank you so much. One of the very best parts of my job is getting to engage students in all of this, especially here in Idaho, where so many of my students grow up in families of farm workers and families of farmers.
Well, we've got to close. I want to thank our listeners for joining us. Remind everyone that Food Sleuth Radio is produced by Dan Hemmelgarn for KOPN in Columbia, Missouri. But most of all, I want to thank my guest, Dr. Cynthia Curl. She's an associate professor and co-director at the Center for Excellence in Environmental Health and Safety at Boise State University. I will provide a link to her lab as well as studies that were most recently published relating to urinary glyphosate concentrations among pregnant participants in a randomized crossover trial of organic and conventional diets, and how proximity to agricultural fields impacts our exposure to herbicide sprays. Thank you so much for your time today, Dr. Curl.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I so appreciate your work.